Today's episode of The Dave Chang Show is brought to you by State Farm. State Farm agents know that in life, anything can happen. You might buy your dream car on impulse or come home to a broken-in apartment. Maybe say yes to a proposal from your significant other and start a family, or find yourself in a fender bender when you least expect it. Whatever happens, when it comes to home and auto insurance, State Farm agents are there to help. And with over 19,000 agents in neighborhoods across the U.S., there could be one just around the corner, so contact an agent today. Because no matter what neighborhood you're from or whatever stage of life you're in, check out statefarm.com today to find an agent in your neighborhood. State Farm. Talk to an agent today. Welcome to the Dave Chang Show, part of the Ringer Podcast Network, presented by Major Domo Media. Thank you to Yola Tango, as always, for letting us use their music in the introduction. A few weeks ago, I put out a APB call for anyone in the creative arts who's about to finish a project, be it a book, another restaurant, film, TV, piece of art, you name it, to come on this podcast and do their own version of a pre-opening diaries about the creative process, the trials and tribulations, their fears and anxieties, the joys, the highs and lows, you name it. It's something that I'm very fascinated about, something I want to learn more about how other people view it. And I was very happy we've been getting a good influx of requests from people that have finished something or about to finish something, and we've been banking a lot of these. So that's what I wanted 2020 to be more of on this podcast, The Dave Chang Show, a little bit more about the creative process of people that I admire. And one of those people I admire quite a bit is Andy Greenwald. You might know him as the host of The Watch on the Ringer Podcast Network. You also might know him because he's written a tremendous amount of content as a critic, both in music, film, and TV, in a lot of publications. And he's just someone that has great takes on culture. And I very much enjoyed The Watch with Chris Ryan as well. It's like listening to two good friends just hash out things in culture. And it's a fun, fun listen. Highly encourage you guys to check it out. But again, one of my favorite things about Andy, he's transitioned from being a critic to a maker. And one of the things I'm trying to get better at as an interviewer is knowing how to figure out how to get people to open up more while being a better listener. This is all very new to me still as I get better at this, get the reps in. And thankfully, Andy was a willing participant in this. And this is about his release of Briar Patch. It's a TV show that's going to be on the USA Network that's going to come out the first week of February, I believe February 6th. And this is a guy that used to criticize TV shows, and here he is making one. And I think that's an incredibly rare thing, something I wanted to dive deeper in. And it gets a little meta during our interview where we start talking about how beneficial it could be to do a pre-opening diaries, about putting yourself out there as a creative person with all of your flaws. You're just totally naked when you put something out there. It's a terrifying feeling. And I think that people need to hear the creative process and the struggle of where Andy himself was going through, which we cover in this podcast. And I wanted to be able to get the artist, in this case, Andy, you know, before other critics get to judge their work or the public at large to judge it, before they judge it, to hear what went into the making. And we dive deeper into that. I won't talk too much about that, but I think there's a nuanced conversation about that. And it's not about saving someone from having their work criticized, but it's just a reminder that there are people behind the work, and some people pour more into it than others. And when it's a personal journey, as it is for Andy, as it is for the other people that will be on this podcast as a pre-opening diaries guest, I just think that maybe the person behind it had something in mind that the audience might not have realized, but they'd appreciate it more if they knew. And I don't know if I was clear in articulating that. I just feel like it's another opportunity before the maelstrom starts with the actual press tour and you'll lose sight of what went through your head in making this whole thing. In this case, Briar Patch, the TV show. And it's a fascinating conversation, in my opinion, to talk to someone that's going from critic to maker. Anyway, it's much more illuminating to hear Andy speak. I will shut the fuck up. Here is our pre-opening diaries of Briar Patch on the USA Network with Andy Greenwald. Well, this is a work in progress. And a couple weeks ago on the podcast, we sort of put a APB out for any creative work that's almost done, about to be released, 70% plus in terms of its completion. And I got a message from you saying, hey, I'd love to talk about Briar Patch.
May or may not have sent it in traffic while listening to you.
So I want to release this week. The show airs February 6th.
Yes, Thursday, February 6th.
And again, this sort of falls perfectly into the scope. We want to do this like a couple weeks before something airs to give an audience ready to get primed and maybe some potential critics, which is something we'll talk about in a little bit.
Sure.
Because I feel like no one really gets to dive deep into the almost finished process.
When I was listening to you say this, I was both like, I was excited because I thought, here's my in. But also, it is the craziest time of my life. And like, I was going to warn you guys when I came in, I'm coming in hot and weird because
perfect.
We are not done. You know, we're still in post. I was on the mix stage for a long time yesterday. Episodes are not locked fully, like sound locked. And it's coming out. And I have successfully, which I'm still shocked about, for like 2 years now, somehow been able to lie to myself that this was never going to be on television. And something about this New Year's holiday, the last roadblock was removed, and now it's just open road towards terrifying unknown. And now you have me in front of a microphone.
And are you in the process right now? It's almost like the seven steps of grieving, I think. Are you in the process where you have to start to tell everyone, this is fucking crazy, I don't know what's happening?
But it's also like people, everything's fine. So I have this thing, I don't know if you have this too, but it's a very big like head, heart, head, body thing where like my head is like, things are going very well. I'm extremely fortunate. I'm proud of the work we did. I work with great people. The people who need to be happy, the network, whatever, are happy. Everything's fine. And so then those people who know everything's fine are like, are you excited? It's a dream come true. And you have to like adopt this rictus grin of like, yes, this is great. I love this. And you hope that at some point the white knuckles will give way to actual enjoyment.
Are you ready for this to be out in the world?
Oh God, no. No, I mean, because and no one can tell me. I have no idea what this is going to feel like. Maybe you can tell me because you've opened things, you know, and there have been so many little deaths along the way in terms of what I thought creativity had to be, and I'm really into it. So like the pilot script, you know, I wrote in this blur in 3 weeks, 3 years ago now, and it was mine, and I was proud of it. I showed it to people, and it did the job it had to do. It opened up doors. People liked it. And then when we did the pilot, and I got a director and a production designer and actors, you have to unlock it, and you have to let them in, and then they make it something else. And then you get into post, and you look at everything you thought you did, and you're like, oh, no. And you die, and you build it again. So this, like, giving up process and letting it be someone else's is part of it. But it's on buses now, dude, and I'm having trouble. I'm having trouble with it. You are a qualified therapist, right?
I've had a lot of therapy about this, actually.
Great. Should we conference call our therapist?
Yes, we should. I can't imagine. The one difference with opening restaurants that I've learned from doing even the TV shows is, and one of the things I've always complained about restaurants is that it's being judged on something that is constantly going to evolve. It's a living, breathing entity. Until like the restaurant maybe one day closes. But for TV show or book or music or album, it's done and it can't change.
Yeah. Well, unless you're George Lucas.
Right. To make it worse.
Yeah. Continually make it worse. That's the dream, guys.
That to me is so terrifying. And I have, like, we've finished the edits for Ugly Delicious Season 2 for a while. And I've just ignored it. You know, it's like, oh, I'm thinking in my mind, maybe that's getting better like a bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to look back in like another month and maybe it gets better.
It's possible. Your perspective will certainly change.
When people talk to you about like when they've viewed it and they've watched it so far and they're very complimentary.
Liars.
You think they're all
No, I think I can hear it. I mean, I think a lot of this goes to something that I know you speak about a lot and think about a lot, which is process versus result. And I think that I grew up very result-minded, like achievement-minded or like, you know, and focused on that as one of the reasons to do something. And for whatever reason, I'm extremely grateful for this. From the minute I wrote the script, which was just like for nobody, the clouds parted. It was the most fun I'd ever had writing anything. This has somehow been able to stay in the world of process. And it's been helped by the fact that it's been like 3 years, you know, of stop, start, and then a lot of do. But I've enjoyed the process. You know, I really, I want to say trust the process, but I'm not happy with the Sixers right now. So we're not going to do that. I've enjoyed every step of it, you know, and the people I've gotten to work with along the way. And I imagine like your world too, the collaborations and the friendships you make are become a key part of it. So I deeply know in my bones that what is going to go on TV for 10 weeks beginning February 6th is just a tiny piece of it, you know? So I'm comfortable with that. And then the flip side of that is also, because I think I worked with so many brilliant people, I hear the compliments for them. Right. And they are earned. And I'm proud of that.
That's a very healthy, like receiving that information is the most healthy way I've ever heard it.
But this is up here in the head. The body is freaking out, man.
Let's back up a little bit.
Sure.
Because I want to phrase this one question, then like dig deeper into it. Are you at a point right now, I know whether your head or body feel differently, do you feel like, you know, it's that Vince Lombardi quote, like even in defeat, like if you leave everything on the field, it's the best. Is this the best effort you could have given?
Yeah, 1,000,000% yes. There's a word that I've been trying to learn, compassion, especially for oneself. And so, you know, I'm very upfront about the fact that I've never done any of this before. Every single step of this for me was the first time, which was incredible and fortunate and sometimes even fun. But there were definitely days or weeks where I was like, could one thing not be a learning experience? Could there just be a Thursday where I'm like, well, I've done Thursdays before? And there wasn't. But so really the worst feelings, especially since we wrapped at the end of September and then in post and thinking about stuff, the worst feeling has been, I should have known, you know, I should have known that changing this one scene is like pulling a thread and the whole thing will collapse. Or I should have known not to trust that this would be done when I wasn't paying attention to it or whatever. But I couldn't know, you know, and I think the tunnel vision that I had at times was definitely self-protective. And I think a healthier person like me, like maybe the ghost of Vince Lombardi, would be like, what a gift to learn these things, you know, and then try it again. But that backwards recrimination is that's the killer.
And you don't get mad at yourself when you see.
Oh, I get so mad. Oh, I get so mad. And I don't do well with
anger.
Is there
anything you can do about it?
Yeah. Well, you can do magic in post. You can manufacture scenes out of times they accidentally left the camera running. You know, you can create new lines. You can tweak. You can do so much with sound and music, which is itself so cool and so fun. So, yeah, you can get it there. But I do think other people have said this, but maybe because you keep insisting mostly cooks listen to this, but I don't think that's true. people in the industry have told me this, and I totally agree that there are three stages where you build and burn it down. You write it, and then you close the door on that, and you make something. And then you see it in post, and you close the door on that, and you build it again. So you have to—it's very emotional in post because you have to, like—this is the analogy I used on The Watch, but my parent—growing up, I had cats, and when a cat would cough up a hairball, my father's, I guess, old-school cat discipline would be he would pick up the cat and push its face into the hairball that it had spat up. Like, look at what you've done. That's what editing is like. You're having your head pushed into your creative hairball, and you just have to learn to live with it. So you can do it, but I think the sort of the more zen, like, be compassionate. You did do your best. And then the people next to you hopefully are like, this is fine. Because they can't see what they can't see the phantom limbs that you see and feel. I wonder if that's that way with a dish. Like, you wanted it to be one extra element of texture, flavor. You never got it there. And someone's like, this is delicious. What are you talking about? But you taste the absence, right? Like, you want it to be, you imagined it differently.
I only can see that on dishes that I know don't work.
And you know in your bones.
Yeah. On dishes that work, I can tolerate the imperfection because I'm like, yeah, over time, it'll get better. Or the cook that's making it 3 months later, I know he'll get it. Mm-hmm. But when it's a mistake that is unquestionably mine,
yeah,
that's very hard. And it's ego that prevented me from doing it. It wasn't even doing it the first time. It was simply hubris that prevented me from making the right decision. I beat the shit out of myself.
Oh, totally, right. And you can't let go of – I mean, what about – so there's something that just happened to me, and I want to put this on you and wonder if this has happened to you, if it happens to you a lot, how you deal with it. there was a scene, I'm not even going to say which episode it was, but it meant a lot to me. I had high hopes for it. We didn't get it. A combination of factors. Not even going to finger, I'll point all the fingers everywhere, but ultimately they pointed at me. I really wanted to get it. And so we spent all this time in edit, like doing surgery on the patient. You know, we're going to save the patient. We're going to save the patient. We're going to add ADR lines. We're going to refocus it and reframe it. And music, music's going to help. What about that great song? And then I showed the scene to Sam Esmail, who's, you know, like our executive producer and the one who sort of helped me accomplish this. And I showed it to him and I turned and he looked at me and he just went, I don't get it. What is it? And, you know, you did so much surgery. There's nothing there. And so there's actually freedom in being like, it didn't work and you lose it. But giving up the thing, I'm still not over it. I'm still upset about it.
How different is that when you write in the Faulkner line of killing your darlings? Is that killing your darling on this?
It's similar. It really is. And learning that, I don't have the muscle yet. Like every time in edit when I had to give up my beautiful baby funny line and everyone's like, you can write another funny line. Like make the best show. I've started to come around to it, but when it was a big like limb, I'm like my beautiful two-armed, two-legged child. You know, but you have to lose an arm. You have to do it. You have to kill your darling sometimes. And then you know in your heart that it's the right move, but you fight it.
For me, over the years, I need to apply data.
Okay.
Because sometimes I won't trust. My ego is so large, I won't trust one or two people. I need to get it out in the world and collect as much data as possible.
So data meaning like have people sample it in this case.
Yeah. Because that's what I need.
I think that in terms of what I'm trying to do, I mean, I want people to like the show. I really do. Not just for my own ego, but I deeply think TV should be entertaining. Like, I'm not asking, this isn't a thing where there's a bar to entry. I'm not saying you have to go to the art house cinema and pay $10 and whatever. I'm coming to you in your living room. You're already in your jammies. You have 500 other shows to watch. Like, I want you to be entertained. But at the same time, I can't chase an audience. I can't chase everyone. You know what I mean? I can only control what I can control. And I want to make something that, you know, hits my benchmarks, that entertains me. And the thing that I keep saying at the end of this, people are like, oh, I think it's great, or how do you feel? And at this moment, pre-opening, I think the show's heart is in its right place. I mean, I think the actors are incredible. You know, I think we had so many great production design, costumes, but I think its heart is in the right place. And I think there are things that we didn't hit, and I'm not going to name them because other people will, and hopefully they'll miss some of them. But we tried, you know, and I feel proud of that. And I can control that. And then I can't tweak the menu in 2 weeks because we'll be done.
Honestly, that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to do pre-opening diaries, because I found now releasing content in a variety of ways in the world and talking to people like you or other friends, whether musicians, artists, mm-hmm. or, you know, authors, that you think that what's in your head, like the scene that you were just talking about with mm-hmm. your executive producer, that people are going to get it, or they're going to understand, or they're going to follow the trail of breadcrumbs that you left.
Yes, they're going to respect me for my intent, my noble intent.
But they don't. Or they can't see it because it's all in your head. Or for whatever reason, it's clear, but they can't see because there's just too much shit in the world.
Yeah.
And
who knows what they're doing at that moment, how they're feeling.
And then once stuff gets you're going to go on a press junket and you're going to promote the hell out of the show, and it's going to find some narrative that makes sense for, mm-hmm. you know, copy in a newspaper, People magazine, Hollywood Reporter, some YouTube thing, and it's going to be a snippet, and then it gets co-opted and turns into something else, and you don't ever get the chance to tell your story.
Yeah.
Once it's out in the world, you can't. You lose it. So that's why I thought to do it before it happens, almost to be like, 8 Mile last scene with Eminem. It's like, this is what it is.
Yeah.
If you don't believe me, this I'm telling you right now, because you can control the narrative in a way that you can't after the fact.
Not to make it too meta and about a podcast about your podcast, but I'm wondering how you feel about the narrative about Kawi, which I wish I could go to. I've not been to New York in a year and a half. It's killing me. Because the pre-opening diaries that you did for that restaurant were really fascinating, really powerful to listen to, really illuminating. She seems like an incredible person. And I felt reading all of the press afterwards, which was really wonderful, I think, especially year-end stuff. I felt the story that you had put into the world in the coverage of the restaurant. I don't know if you guys feel that way. And I don't mean to make it sound like cynical.
100%.
Yeah.
And this is a complicated thing and a lot to talk about or unpack. So the pre-opening diaries, though, was incredibly fruitful for Cowie because we let it all out there, including how, you know, I would say buffoonish a lot of our attempts were to get the restaurant right. And I think critics listen to it.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that there are different audiences, right? Different tiers of audiences. And for me, and I read, like, food stuff is my, that's what I'm interested in. I would much rather be talking about that. I would much rather be reading about it. And so reading the larger narrative, you know, so, you know, we've never really sat down before, but watching your moves in your restaurants and feeling a personal spirit behind these moves, you know, even when they're messy, even when you cop to something that didn't work out or whatever, is part of the story. And I think that's a good part of the story. You know, I love it when, I think, did you have the Sarahs who have Kismet on?
No, we haven't. Oh, we should.
So I don't know them. Again, super fan. And they just opened this Kismet rotisserie here in Los Angeles. It's amazing. We went on the second day. It's like how people should be eating. It's wonderful. And I went in with my daughter, and they're there. You know, one Sarah's behind the line and one Sarah's in the front. And I'm getting this, like, exciting charge, but I'm also feeling really welcomed because I know the fuller story of the restaurant. And that is more than the food, and you can't always control that. But I appreciate getting that big picture. Not because I'm being manipulated into liking something, but because I feel more connected to it artistically or creatively.
Absolutely. And the reason why I wanted to sort of do this is I do this for albums that I'm excited to come out or books that are coming out. I'm going to read everything about it. And why shouldn't that be for restaurants? Whether it's a Uber ride, cab ride to it, you could plane ride. Like, people fly to Noma.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they listen? They read everything about it. Why wouldn't they listen to a podcast about what's for dinner?
Also, because when you sit down at a restaurant, you know, especially it's one you've tried to get into and it's buzzy and crowded, whatever, I think civilian people feel pressure, you know, like, oh, this is my moment. I don't want to fumble this. What should I order? I don't want to make a mistake. And that gets into their head, you know, because they've waited for a table or whatever. And that affects your experience, right?
And it also affects it from the restaurant's end because you don't want to seem condescending or too verbose explaining this is what the chef believes. This is our mission this month, whatever, whatever. And it's also the same for your TV show, right? Whether people know you from The Ringer or The Watch or when you're at Grantland or all your other work, some people will, some people won't. But I think if you leave something that's necessarily evergreen, but transparently leave your thoughts and your feelings about what you're doing, then people can go down that rabbit hole on their own volition.
Yeah.
And then it becomes more powerful.
Yeah, and it forges more of a connection. And I think that forging connections is harder and harder and more valuable to people on both sides of it. And I was really surprised. You know, I want – the show will stand on its own. It's a show. Hopefully people like it. People won't like it. I am, you know, ready for whatever's coming my way. Therapist on speed dial. But I was really warmly surprised that we went to the Toronto Film Festival to premiere the first two episodes while we were in production. So it was the craziest time that I can ever remember.
Did NBC make you do that?
No. Well, yes and no. So Toronto Film Festival.
Yes.
NBC makes you fly places too, right?
Yeah, sometimes.
This is something else we have in common. They never make me go to Tokyo. I will happily switch. They make me go to Albuquerque. It was a big deal. They've never had a show land in a film festival. And so they wanted to show the first two episodes. So there was a moment this summer when we were block shooting episodes 5 and 6, I was flying back to LA to edit 2 quickly. I was prepping 7, rewriting 8 and 9, and writing 10. And there was this moment at LAX at 6 a.m. where I was like, this is the hardest thing that's ever happened. I never want to do this. Then suddenly I had this moment of clarity, like the only thing worse than doing this would be not doing this.
How'd you get that information that you had to premiere first two episodes at Toronto Film Festival, TIFF? Was it through email? Was it a call? Was it
a
text?
It was we had been told that they were submitting
and did you
to
think
be considered.
That it would happen?
No. I don't think any. I mean, if someone came in the studio right now and said, congratulations, you've made it this far, we're taking the show away, I'd say, been waiting for you. I mean, there is no moment where I think that's actually going to happen. I was on the phone expressing this feeling yesterday or 2 days ago, and a bus drove by with an ad for the show, drove past me. And I was like, well, that's a mistake. I'd known that they had been petitioning or submitted, and I didn't think it was going to happen. And then we were shooting episode 4, and I got a note that the network wanted to call me. So I went back to my trailer, and they were like, congratulations. And I was like, thanks, you know, because it's everything you, of course I want to share it with people. Of course I'm honored. Of course I'm proud. But every opportunity comes with this like kick in the ass of like, it's just going to be harder. And the reason I started that was really mostly to say that when I got it on stage and I was terrified to introduce it, there were people in the crowd who listened to the podcast and they were so warm, you know, and that meant so much to me because they feel, and I don't take this for granted, like, they're along for the ride. They might not like the show, but they're part of the larger ride that this has been.
So you've seen some of the benefits of just being able to talk about it on your own podcast, right? Just it's a little bit of self-defense, I think, right? Like inoculates people, but also I just don't know why we don't do more of this, quite frankly.
People made this stuff, you know, not just me. Like people, and this is in the restaurants too, and I'm sure you feel the same way about everyone from front of the house to dishwashers. Like, people are working hard and bringing themselves to it, and that's what makes it good. It's not just something, and I think it's more important now that everything feels more disposable, right? More clickable. You could just,
Before the, and I've been to TIFF, so before the lights dimmed and they start showing Briar Patch, what was going through your mind?
You know, they do this thing where, like, I'm in this hotel room and I'm freaking out and they drive me to the thing and freaking out. And then I saw Rosario and I felt a little bit better because if you ever have to do something like this, I highly recommend doing it with Rosario Dawson, who is one of the greatest human beings on earth. And, you know, just like, she just like took my hand and was like, we're fine. We had to introduce it, you know, I had to introduce it. So they called me out and the guy introduced me like Chris does on the podcast, which was terrifying. And my parents flew up. Did not ask them to come. They did not want them to come. They came. So I was totally freaking out. And then the lights went down and I was sitting in the crowd with Rosario and with Lily Amirpour, who directed the pilot. And because I was with my friends who had made this with me, I actually had fun, you know. But in that moment, because I just had this big fear that as soon as we got there, it was going to become about the outcome. And it was going to be thumbs up, thumbs down, Rotten Tomatoes, you're done. And I was still making it, and I wanted to enjoy that longer. But when I was in the room with the people who had made it with me and nice people who listened to the podcast, I felt good. It felt good.
You for sure thought about all the outcomes that were negative and how that would affect the process.
I tried not to. Denial is a very powerful drug. I mean, there was a version of it in my head, and no one ever said this to me. But what if we had put it up there and people had been like, well, this is a fart, this is a joke. You let this dummy do this and you've got nothing, then we're still making it. So then does our funding dry up? Does our marketing dry up? Do we vanish?
That's what I'm talking about. That's the motion that I'm looking for right now.
I don't go that far. People often misunderstand my neuroses, including an executive at USA or at the studio at UCP, our production executive, who says, I say I have a headache. And she's like, oh, you probably think you have a brain tumor, huh? I'm like, no, that's your other Jewish friend. I just think I'm going to have this headache forever. And I had a good run being non-headache guy, but now I'm Mr. Headache forever. So that feeling of like being up and everything being nervous and scary, like that's my permanent state now. Mm. I somehow have boarded over the deep hole. And then the reviews came out and they were, you know, there were some that were, because I think 4 or 5 trades reviewed it after TIFF, the first two episodes. And 2 or 3 of them were just so kind and nice, and I immediately discounted those. That's nonsense. I'm not going to look at those. And then the others were basically like, this could be good. And that's how I feel. You know, I'm like, you saw 2 episodes. We're not done. That's the best thing you could say. This could be good. Let me show you. I'm going to keep working on it.
I'm going to talk more about Andy's bio and his sort of history before in the intro. But if you don't know, he has been a culture critic, TV critic, for what publications?
Well, Ringer, I started at Spin. Spin. I was a music critic. For a long time, and then I wrote a little bit for like Blender when it existed, and Entertainment Weekly, and Vulture, and then Day One at Grantland on the TV beat.
How many times have you ripped something up?
This is, you know, always fairly, always with real kindness, with some frequency, for sure. The story I tell myself And there's reams of digital evidence to the contrary. Well, here's where I start from. I think people think, and I wonder if you feel this way about food critics as well, I think people assume critics like to hate things. And in my experience, I love TV. I love it. And I want to love things. And what I had to sort of regulate, and maybe this is what led me to ultimately making it, was being personally upset when I didn't like something, like as if something was being done to me as opposed to just a choice that I didn't agree with. And so that would inform more inflammatory critiques. There were things that I ripped that I would stand by, which things that I felt were deeply cynical. You know, that just, there isn't a heart behind this that I can feel, you know. That would get some pretty mean stuff out. But I definitely was using the platform that Bill gave me, you know, again, like, trying to be being a freelance writer for failing magazines for 10 years, and all of a sudden Bill Simmons is like, here, borrow my audience. I went at people.
Do you have any like shit I was wrong moments?
I mean, I think I always tried to be empathetic because I always tried to bring it a perspective of the industry. You know, I wasn't like a Victorian New Critic being like, the only thing that I'm considering is the images on the screen. Like, I know that this is a business. I know that business factors into every single decision you see on the screen, and sometimes in good ways and sometimes in bad ways. So I tried to take a more like holistic, like, here's what may have gone wrong here kind of approach. But I mean, I never wrote a negative review of something that I secretly liked, you know? I probably could have made the piece more about things that I did appreciate, but sometimes I got really upset about stuff.
Now, because I could talk about this relationship literally for a week, and I will spare the audience because that's my own neuroses. But now that Briar Patch is coming out, and you've made it clear that your intent was as pure and perfect as possible to do something great.
Yeah.
In the event that a critic just rips it up, how do you feel about that?
Well, I definitely respect and understand the role of the critic, and I'm not going to step on it, and I'm not going to clap back.
But what is the role of the critic then?
Well, what I love about criticism and what I really tried to do was, there's a forest trees thing, right? Like, when you are making something, you are so focused on the tree that you're – this is a failed metaphor already because you don't build a tree, but you're looking at a tree, right? You're whittling a tree. I haven't written in a long time. But as a critic, you can look at the forest and say, there are many trees here. Some are good, some are bad. Here's where this tree relates to the other elements of the forest. And that perspective, that was really helpful, I felt like, when I first went into writers' rooms and crossed over to the other side. I think critics can contextualize ideas and draw focus on ideas or emotions that you don't even realize you're playing with, and sometimes in an instructive way. Like, you're playing with this thing here, and maybe you didn't do it justice. Maybe by juxtaposing these two themes, you are short shrifting this other one, you know, and noticing things that I've lost the ability to notice in a way that I can learn and grow from. Or even just as you said, if someone loves it in a way that I don't even understand, why? Right. Why that touched you like that? I had no idea. So I'm excited for that. One of the reasons I got out of criticism was that I did feel like I was trying really hard to be creative or artistic or something in every piece that I did. But because of the kind of deadening effect of Twitter, like, I was just shoveling the same snow as everyone else. And plus, there's 600 TV shows. So my job became less about championing or investigating or interrogating or these high-minded ideas I had, and more about, like, I'm a wealth management consultant.
Right.
And my consumers have 8 hours. And if they spend those hours poorly, they'll blame me. And I didn't love that aspect of the job.
Then, what do you think are potential weaknesses of this?
Of my show?
Yeah.
Oh, I know.
What do you think a critic will say?
Well, one thing that was really nice about the reviews, even the ones that were positive that had little, you know, ticks and whatever, I'm like, oh, you didn't see, you missed the big ones. I know. I mean, I'm a critic. I know the problems. I know the things that don't work. I know the things I wish we had done better. And I probably will always know them better than anybody else. So when someone gets one, I'm like, secretly, I'll be like, oh, okay, good for you. Notice that. You know, I think that one of the things that we tried to do with the show is, you know, this comes from being a critic. There's too many shows. So if you have the opportunity to make one, don't go small. Don't make a safe choice. Make a big, big, big choice. run towards a thing that you're a little bit afraid of and see what happens. And so each episode of Briar Patch intentionally is a little bit different. I mean, there's a giant action episode. There's an episode that's a little more soap operatic and emotionally driven. There's essentially a heist episode, you know. There's a very emotional funeral episode. So that was intentional because I wanted to take big swings and do different things. The other thing that I think about this a lot, and I wonder if you think about it too, considering your career, there are things that I begin to focus on like, oh, you know, now that I've been through production of 10 episodes, I would never write a script like that because I just murdered a line producer. And these poor people in locations are never going to talk to me again. Now I know how to constrain those ideas and make them, I mean, the word you use a lot is scalable, right? Like I can do it. And then the next thought is, I'll never have this magic again. I'll never be so stupid and naive in the best way again. And so then you go down to that pit of, well, this is the best thing I'll ever do.
This is such a fascinating place to be. And I'm so glad we're talking. And you're in that awful, amazing place.
You said that in the right order.
Yeah, right. Because whenever I make a restaurant, I'm always thinking when it's about to launch, I was like, okay, these are all the things that suck.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that I know will only get better with time.
Okay. Right?
Whether that's cooks getting more reps or whatever, but these are design flaws that are going to haunt us forever.
And no one can tell you. Pete Wells can't tell you X, Y, or Z thing, right? You know.
But those are things that I'm not necessarily worried about. The things that I guess I'm asking you are there like structural elements that are problematic? We've been getting a lot of feedback on the restaurant we just opened in Las Vegas, and someone said like, oh, you know what? Like, I don't like this. We called a dish spaghetti, and people were like, people want red sauce. I was like, my first reaction is like, what?
Yeah.
We just change it. Things we can change, but there are other elements like, you know, whether it's the right kind of dessert or, but we've gotten one feedback from a pretty influential person and they said, I don't like the menu. I don't like how it looks and I don't like the feel of it. And then I have to think, who is this person? Mm-hmm. Do they have a good taste? Mm-hmm. All these things. And I'm getting real feedback and I can see, I was like, is this how a real critic might look at it too?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm like after, because certain things are personal preference.
Mm-hmm.
And Briar Patch is going to get reviewed by how many outlets? I don't know. What happens when someone gets it wrong?
Oh, they will. They 100% will. And I think I just have to say, you know, not everybody likes everything. Not everyone is the target audience. And, you know, so one of the things that I said a lot to the writers when we had the writers' room was, this is a murder mystery show. It's about a woman who returns to her existentially corrupt hometown, West Texas border town, fictional place, because her 10 years younger sister is blown up and she goes back to find out why. We are not better than a genre. Like, people love murder mysteries. I love to watch shows like that. We have to service this. We have to consider a fan of, you know, procedural shows, or my mom might want to tune in here. And if we do our best to service this mystery to the best of our ability, you're going to find out who killed her sister by the end of the 10 episodes. It's a complete story over the course of the season. Then we earn the right to do the things that I really care about, which are weirder, more surreal, more emotional, more experimental, you know, more vibey. That was one rule. The second rule is, even if people don't want to admit it, but I say this with a lot of love and confidence from a lifetime reading paperback crime novels, who did it is the least interesting question in a show like this. It is. You think it's the most important. And, you know, we have like a commentariat online who's like, answer the question. We want answers. But that's actually not that interesting. What's interesting is everything that swirls and circles around it and the bigger, deeper dive you can do because you have this spine of a question people are interested in. So I really tried to service the mystery. I also knew that if at the end of episode 10, if critics are like, but why did he go back there? We've lost. We've already lost. Instead, they should be like, what a fun ride. I loved being with these people, because my favorite books and the writers who inspired me, or Ross Thomas, whose book I took a lot of liberties with, read that book and tell me what happened. Like, really tell me, beat it out, and then use your Twitter brain to be like, well, that doesn't make sense or whatever. That's not what it's about. It is about, I'm excited to try it right now in real time. I'm thinking about it from your perspective, and it's just like, the list of items on the menu and the cooking versus the experience. right? The room you're sitting
that's
in.
That's really all that matters.
It's the experience. At the end of it.
It's how you leave something.
That's what you remember.
And that's why I'm always like, I don't care per se. I'm going to accumulate all of these opinions mm-hmm. and aggregate them to something that makes sense where I can determine, okay, majority of people leave here being like, I'm so happy I spent my money and this was a wonderful experience versus I hate this fucking place.
Yeah.
And I'm always concerned with, I don't know why, critics getting it right or seeing it. Mm-hmm. And this is where I always get mad at myself because I don't want to sound like Donald Trump, right? Like the fucking media. But do you believe that all the critics that are going to watch this are going to take it as seriously as you would?
No. As a critic or as a creator?
As a critic.
I don't want to. I mean,
and
I don't
as
want
a creator, right? Like there's got to be.
Well, one thing I just have to put away is that no one can. I mean, I've just been working on this show with every fiber of my being for years. And so no one can do that in a review. They have too much other stuff to do, you know?
But that's exactly. There's too many TV shows. Yeah. How do they put the right amount of spotlight and effort into yours?
That I don't know. And I don't want to assume the motives of anyone, you know. But so like I did find out that there's a review coming from someone who didn't like the show, fine, who watched one episode. And that's my only...
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
We gave them eight. Unmixed, but we gave them eight because I got nothing to hide. I'm like, I'm proud of this. I know where there are peaks and valleys, but I think it ends really strong. And I think 7, 8, 9, 10, I'm really, really excited and proud of to share with people. And I'm proud of all of them, whatever. But I wouldn't do that in today's marketplace. I know there's a lot of stuff to watch, but we gave you more.
Can we just call this person out?
No.
Come on.
No, I can't.
Well, what's going to come out? We're going to know.
It hasn't come out. I was just told this was happening by my publicist. But it's okay. Like, from what I understand, the other thing is this. If someone watches one episode of this and it's just like, it's not for me, that's okay because I promise you, it's for me. Like, I think it's funny. You know, I think the show is weird. Like, it celebrates things that I love personally, and I'm excited to share with people. And, you know, I was about to say a lifetime. It just felt like it. From a bunch of years of being a TV critic, reviewing these, like, serious man dramas, and just saying again and again, like, I just don't believe in darkness without light. I won't feel the dark, serious emotions unless you counterbalance it. Because people laugh at funerals, man. Like, life is weirder than dark punishment. So I got to make a show that hopefully hits both. It's a tough tone, but the show's funny.
I mean, the first episode, I think, pretty clearly lays that out.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's weird and it's funny, but that's my MO. And I get it if you don't, it's okay if you don't feel that way. I do think that if you were a critic trying to tell an audience, you might be curious where it goes, at least through three.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. Today's episode of The Dave Chang Show is brought to you by Buckley Dog Food. We all know that good food comes from good ingredients, and the same applies to pet food. That's why Buckley Dog Food is all about quality, real ingredients. Their food only contains fresh meat and whole ingredients and never any rendered meat meals, which are the cheap way many pet foods spike protein levels in their food. Meat meal can contain terrible stuff, including meat from diseased animals, and they lower your dog's ability to digest the protein and get the nutrients they need. But Buckley's dry recipe have an average protein digestibility of over 90%, while industry average is around 70%. Buckley's recipes are preferred 5-to-1 because they don't have any rendered meat meals, byproducts, or filler ingredients. Just fresh meat and whole ingredients. I have a rescue dog named Sevi, and he is a particularly funny dog because he is not food motivated. So it's been incredibly hard to get him to eat well, but he's finally putting on weight after nearly 6 years because he really likes Buckley dog food. So I just know that he likes it. He's tried a lot of other dog foods. In fact, I've even made food for him and he doesn't even like it, but he has been thankfully finally putting on some weight because he loves Buckley. And that is good enough for me. So go to buckleypet.com/Chang and use the code Chang, C-H-A-N-G, for 20% off your first order and learn about their dog food subscriptions. That's buckleypet.com/Chang and use the code Chang for 20% off. And now, back to the show. And now that you're in this moment, did you ever feel more empathy for the TV shows or music that you sort of were heavily critical of?
I want to say yes so badly. I want to say no so badly. Yeah, Yeah, well, of course, because no
we're
one...
human. You're going to make mistakes.
Yeah,
but
no one tries to make something bad, you know? No one does, I don't think, unless... I don't know, there was that NBC show, The Slap, that I still feel like... I still feel like there was something was rotten in Denmark on that one. But in general, no, people are trying to make stuff.
And you're trying to determine, again, did they really try? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't...
think there's a difference.
I think you're right. And I do think that I started to chafe under, like, I wanted to stop living in my head and reacting and responding to other people's things. And I think probably, I mean, you said this a moment ago, we were talking about, like, reactions to an experimental dish, right? Like, love and hate are the same thing. You're just still a way to, like, tightly bind yourself to something. When I got really angry about shows, in retrospect now, it's probably because I wanted to do... I didn't admit it at the time. I was very church and state. Like, I wasn't trying to pursue this career when I was reviewing, but it was because it became personal to me because I wanted to do rather than react.
I think that's powerful. And one reason why I'm continually stuck on this is I think we need an ombudsman or something for critics to keep them honest about, are they mailing it in, or are they really trying to determine, is the creator giving their best effort, even though we know it's imperfect? It's how I describe home cooking or grandma's food. It's perfectly imperfect, and that's the food you want to eat.
It is, absolutely. Absolutely.
But we've, not just food criticism, I think media of all sorts, where the criticism has become sterilized and reductive to the point where it's not necessarily Rotten Tomatoes, but it seems like everything's sort of headed that way, where I have to have a hot take, and this is what I hate about it.
Well, it's either I have to have a hot take, or more often I have to just get in line with the same take.
Right.
You know, it's either way, it is flatter, I think, and blander than we had hoped it would be with this many voices. But I also think that, you know, publications across the board are slashing funds, and, you know, being someone who has the luxury of thinking about stuff for a living, there are fewer and fewer people can do that.
So we've talked about, and you're not going to go nearly as deep as I think I would love you to, because you have to talk to critics, I'm sure. What do you think people are going to take away that are genuinely positive? They're going to be like, this was the best. Or do you even not think that?
About my show?
Yeah.
Well, I think the acting is amazing.
Amazing actors, by the way.
How did you do that? Believe the actors that I have. A combination of things. I mean, Rosario obviously was first, and
when you wrote it 3 years ago, you thought
I didn't. What part of the free experience was like? So the book, it's about a man, and I changed it to a woman. I was much more interested in what that would do to the story. I was much more interested in writing. I mean, someone returning to their bad hometown to deal with shit is a very oft told and particularly masculine told story. I was much more interested in from a female perspective. But I didn't have a person. I didn't describe the character. I described her eyes, but I didn't describe what she looked like. Rosario felt amazing. You know, early on I was like, I didn't think you could get anybody, you know? And then someone suggested Rosario and I was like, we can't do that, can we? And then the next thing you know, I'm sitting with her and she's awesome and she wants to do it. And she said no to everything. She was always the poster child for the most sought after actor during pilot season, but she responded to it. And then she was on board. And then other parts, you know, every part had its own journey.
You got Kim Dickens.
But like Kim Dickens is something like, who worked with you?
I know.
We talked about you on set, actually.
I feel so bad that she had to act.
She acted with you.
With me.
She
Holy
told
shit.
Me the funniest stories about working with David Simon, where she'd be like, you know, because he's such a believer in truth and accuracy above anything else. So she's like, I would be on set with these jazz musicians. And I'd be like, is he going to hit his marks? And David's like, it doesn't matter. He's a jazz musician. She's like, okay. So she went with it. But you know, she's one of the greatest people in the world. I love her.
She's so lovely.
She had nothing but nice things to say about you. So that was an example of, at that point, she's not in the pilot. She's one of the stars of the show, but she joins the show in episode two. And at that point, we had something to show people. You know, the people who sign on to a pilot are really, you have to sit with them. They have to trust you, you know, and that's a big leap. So Jay Ferguson, who is one of our great American actors, who I think is the best he's ever been selfishly on Briar Patch. People know him a lot from Mad Men. he's done this for a long time. He's been an actor 25 years.
He's longer. Not 38.
No, he's 45. He's 45. In the show, everyone's 38. All Ross Thomas protagonists are 38 or 39 because he felt that was the last year you could plausibly make mistakes before people called you to account for them.
But, so, you know, very true.
I think it's true. It's a really powerful, but he acted as a teenager with Burt Reynolds, and I'm like, come join this thing with a part that scared him because he hadn't done this stuff. So it was a huge leap of faith that I'm grateful for. But anyway, we had the pilot, we got the series order, and then I'd created this role that doesn't exist in the book of a female police chief who I thought would be a really unique antagonist to Rosario's character. In the pilot, it's almost all men, and she's traversing this land of wolves where she can't show any emotion and she can't be happy, she can't be sad because she doesn't trust them. And I had this vision of a new kind of character for her to deal with who, when she saw her, hugged her, which would be the worst thing you could do to a character like Allegra. And so you write it, and I'm writing it like as a Kim Dickens type, you know? And then the casting people are like, well, what about Kim Dickens? Write her a letter. And so I just write a letter. And then they read the letter, and then they say they want to meet, you know? And that happened with Alan Cumming, too. Like, I wrote him a letter. Ed Asner, I wrote him a letter. And you say, like, this is what I think of you. This is what I see for you. And this is what we're trying to do here, you know? And then they come play. And
that's beautiful, man.
It was amazing. I mean, it's like, it's dream after dream. And like the next thing you know, you look around and, you know, these people, it was so fun to cast because like Peter Stormare from Fargo, the movie, you know, and from Armageddon and these, is in our show in this small part in one episode because it was the type of person that he should play. And so you say like, would you ever do this? And actors want to work. And they like doing stuff they haven't done before. So, I mean, Alan said, I still can't believe Alan was on the show. Alan showed up and he's like, this is the dream character because everyone talks about him for three episodes. And then he shows up and everyone's scared of him. He's like, you want to have little to do, but everyone talk about you. So that was great. I mean, I loved, you hear horror stories about actors and whatever, but that was one of the highlights of this experience is working with these actors. As you know, as an actor yourself.
I always say the reason why Treme wasn't picked up for another season was because of my acting abilities or lack thereof. And I think Kim, that was so hard. Now I know why no one really makes food movie dramas.
But she still talks about she can make an omelet now.
She was really cooking.
She talks about it.
I just remember a scene where, now I know how hard your job is too, just filming 5 minutes takes 15 hours.
Oh my God.
Can you explain actually before there's no point in me talking about my lack of acting skills, but.
You can do that on the watch.
How insane is it to get content done?
It's so hard. This is the thing that I thought I knew, and then now I really understand. If you're watching a TV show or a movie, every single thing that you see, no matter how minute, whether it's someone's sideburns or whether it's a glass on the table, was a decision. Someone made that decision for that to be there. And every scene, you know, a three-page scene between two characters can take most of a day, depending how many days you have and how you budget and how many cameras you have.
How frustrating is that? Does that ever get easier?
There's something beautiful. Like some writers don't like to be on set. Like Damon Lindelof, who I've become friendly with, doesn't like to be on set. He doesn't think he's useful there. You know, he does the writing, obviously, he does prep, and he's in post. I love being on set because maybe it's because I used to be a theater dork, but like I love making stuff and I love watching all these people who know what they're doing do it. So you wake up at 5 for a 6 a.m. call, and then you start with the wide shot and you do the scene 4 or 5 times, and then you move and you stop. Everyone goes eat snacks. There's never any shortage of snacks. You move in and you do one person's coverage. You turn it around, do the other person's coverage. You know, and there's just this monotonous. And this is the thing that I was hoping we could talk about too, which is that it's not always art. You know, there's what's the word that you choose to use, but like
it's not glamorous.
It's not glamorous. You know, it's not just putting the last. Finishing salt.
It's not magic either. It's just
you work. Do the job.
It's very workmanlike.
It's workmanlike. You have to, you have to chop stuff basically.
But no one knows how no one wants to know how the sausage gets made. And having now seen just any filmmaking, movie process, TV, it is so insanely inefficient. I can't wrap my head around it.
And people come on set and they're excited, and then they get bored within 5 minutes. Everyone who comes to visit, there's a pattern. You come on set and they're so excited. Oh, is that really her bedroom? It looks like, oh, and it's in this studio. Incredible. Are those snacks free? Amazing. Oh, here comes Rosario Dawson. I can't wait. And I get to put these headphones on. 10 minutes later, they are so deep in their phone, you cannot pull them out of it because they've now memorized the scene.
So if there's like, if this was a dialogue for 5 minutes,
yeah,
you're shooting that every angle possible.
Yep.
Over and over. And I don't know, I can't explain it to someone how impossibly long it takes.
It takes so long, and then you have dummies like me running. I sprint in, and you hear all the ADs going, Andy's coming in with a note. Andy's coming. No, stand down. He's fine. He's fine. He says it's fine. But I'm like running in, and I'm like, okay, but what if it was this? What if it was this? And telling the director, and like, you know, and then they're all rolling their eyes because they want to get to lunch.
Did you go in thinking that this is my one shot, and this is it, I'm putting it all out there, laying it all on the line?
On set in Albuquerque, well, I can always go back to my true love, blogging. It's there. It's right there waiting for me. I do think, and again, this is also why that David Epstein Range interview was in my head. Like, I'm so grateful that I'm doing this, and we're the same age. So, like, that I was doing this at this moment, and that I had other jobs and other experiences. It allowed me to appreciate it more, but also I think allowed me to have some perspective. Like, I have existed in the world as someone who didn't have a TV show.
If this happened to you when you were 27, how different would it have been?
What a nightmare. What a nightmare.
Why?
Well, one, what did I have to say about anything? Two, I don't think I had the necessary separation of, like, I took a fiction writing class in college and my observations about New England buildings in autumn are universal, you know? The perspective of, whereas on a show like this, I can be like, I've got fucking Rosario Dawson in a power suit and I've got all these other funny, amazing, great things. And then using them, maybe we can have some subtext about emotion or family or psychology that interests me. Being able to realize that those are two separate things and my own navel is not worthy of 10 episodes. But also just like all the work that people, well, us, I think, from listening to your podcast, have gotten to do on ourselves. You know, is to be a little bit more humble and prepared for things. That idea of like, this is what you want, but what does it mean? What's it going to cost? Like, it's not just here's your reward. Now go do this thing. There's, you know, I had to live in Albuquerque for 4 months, basically.
Did you bring your wife and kids?
No, because their life is here. So I was coming back and forth. You know, and it takes a toll on everybody. So having the perspective about all of those things, and also just about like not getting too far, tipped over too far into this being everything. Like, it was really important to me that not to be an asshole, not to hire assholes. Like, I think that there's a thing in writers' rooms and maybe in kitchens, maybe in just all workplaces, like the myth of the difficult genius. I was like, life's too short, man. This is hard enough. It's not worth it to me to have someone who might have the most outside the box idea in a room with me who poisons it for everyone else. So we had nice people who were, you know, come from extremely diverse backgrounds, who contributed to the show. And, you know, we ended the writer's room every day at 5 because I wanted to have dinner with my family. Hmm. And we still did it. Now, is episode 6 10% less good because I did that? Someone may say that, but I think it was the right calculation.
Was Briar Patch the first attempt at trying to get a show made? Because you've worked on other TV shows before.
Yeah, that's the crazy thing. So I was writing books and magazine stuff in New York. And then Josh Schwartz, who did the OC and just
who I know,
for Alaska.
He's a good foodie. He's a big foodie.
Exactly. I saw him at Bavel in DTLA. And like, he walked in straight from his Looking from Alaska premiere and like looking amazing. So I wrote a story about him for GQ years ago. We became friends. And then he was doing a web series for Warner Brothers and asked me to contribute a script. And I did. And then he asked me to contribute another one. And I loved it. I was like, I want to do that. Why didn't this occur to me? This is fun because it's interactive and make people talk. So I turned a book I was writing into a spec script, but was not going to leave New York. And so I never really made the jump, but I was kind of, I had an agent and I was kind of, and then Grantland started and I was like, well, I'm just going to do this now because I didn't feel like I could do both and be fair. And also finally, you know, it was an amazing opportunity and great people. And I got to talk to and meet all the people I was interested in creatively. And then at the end of it, I was getting that feeling we were talking about, like just ready to maybe try something creative. And my contract was going to end and I was going to write a spec script just to start over and to maybe be able to do this. And then two things happened right before my contract ended. Noah Hawley came on the podcast, never met him. And at the end of it, he texted me and then called me the next day and asked if I wanted to help him adapt a Kurt Vonnegut novel, which was unbelievable good fortune and kindness. I was like, yeah, actually, I'm going to have some free time. And then Grantland shut down 3 days before my contract ended. So I was like, I guess I can do this.
Good story.
So I came to LA, worked with him for 2 weeks. At the end of the 2 weeks, he asked me to jump on Legion season one. I was like, I can't. I live in New York. And all credit to him. He was like, I don't care, Skype in or whatever. So I Skyped into the writer's room, which annoyed the professional writers to no end, and then flew out here a couple times. And by the end of that experience, I was like, I do love this. I do want to do this. So we moved here in the fall of 16, and my agents were like, people here know you because you've been ripping their shows for 6 years, but they don't know you as this. So why don't you just take one of those books you're always talking about, just write something. And so I was like, okay. And I'd had this idea. Russ Thomas is my favorite writer. I'd thought about doing something with Briar Patch for a long time. Did it in 3 weeks. It went right to Sam's producing partner, and Sam, and they wanted to do it right away. So this is a totally outrageous good fortune story. Of course, no one had the rights. Paramount owned the rights. So then the squealing brakes of Hollywood hit the whole thing. And I did work with Sam on something else in the interim. But in terms of like, yeah, this was the first time I was like, I wrote the script and I was like, let's try it. People are going to hate that.
Because you didn't pay your dues like everyone else?
But I think about it. Okay, I'm using your podcast to justify my existence because that thing that David Epstein was talking about everyone thinks they're a black swan, so don't pay attention to them. I was writing for 20 years.
Yeah.
I just didn't have this to say yet.
People get mad when you don't do it the way that everyone else did it.
But I firmly believe this. If you want to write for TV, do not move to Los Angeles. Do not take a PA job. Do not start answering someone's phone just because you'll be near it. Live a life. Have something to say. Your value will increase exponentially if you have a perspective that's not the perspective of what's good at Mendocino Farms. Like that, the being here, I feel like everything that I've brought here came from outside of here. Although the restaurants are good here now.
The restaurants are very good in LA. Have there been any other I always think in the world of food, critics that have gone to the other side?
Yes. I mean, people like to joke about Pauline Kael, the famous film critic who like came to LA for 2 years to work on a studio lot and then went back to New York. Who else is actually, like Rod Lurie, who's made a bunch of movies, I think was a critic. Now I think there are a lot of people who have worked in magazines and done different kinds of criticism working out here just because the world of media is contracted.
But do they have their own show? You might be the first.
I might be the first. I don't want to presume that I am.
Well, let's presume that you are, because there's not more than five.
It's possible.
What if you are the first of your kind?
Well, I want to make it very clear. I'm pulling the ladder up behind me. This is it.
You're like Wesley Snipes in Blade.
That's it, man. We're done.
You're a daywalker.
I'm like him in so many ways, on and off
camera.
Don't
pay taxes.
Don't pay taxes. I was great in Major League. I'm surprisingly shorter in person.
Why does this give you an advantage?
In which field?
Making this TV show.
I think it goes back to that terrible failed tree and forest metaphor that I'm going to, for some foolish reason, try again. Which was that I think that I have a feeling just from being a part of it where the culture is and what – I never made any decision about the show like, oh, I think people are ready for this. Like they want this. But I do think I understand people's viewing habits, their viewing patience, you know, in terms of like, let's get on with it. Let's make this more – in terms of I'm making it from the perspective of not someone who's going to find everything that I do interesting, but someone who has a pile of 10 other screeners and a deadline. So what can be in this show that might grab them and make it more compelling for them? And I also think that there were decisions we made. I mean, there's a storyline in the show that touches on the border because the fictional town is located near the Texas-Mexico border. And there's a character who is a border patrol agent. And so I was very mindful of like, that's not my story to tell. The story has been done many times and done badly. So we brought in a brilliant writer named Francisco Cantu, who wrote this amazing memoir. You should talk to this guy called The Line Becomes a River. He's a Mexican-American guy who became a border patrol agent to better understand the world that he was being affected by and interested in. So he was a consultant on our show, came into our room, inspired character. And the jury is out on how we did with the storyline. I think ultimately one thing I learned is that you can't do full justice to every single thing. I hope we did it small justice. But I definitely was in my head like, okay, I'm playing with something that matters. This isn't just a toy for me in the abstract in a writer's room in Hollywood.
But don't critics or just people that are going to consume this expect you to do justice to every single thing? That's what's a weird disconnect.
I think they might. And I think that, and I don't want to say, I don't want to make it sound like other people aren't consumed with these thoughts, but I definitely was, I'm more recently removed from a world of that hyper-awareness and that hyper-criticism. And I don't know if that makes better art necessarily. Mm. Like bringing up Damon again, like I really respect that Damon is off Twitter. He truly just doesn't engage in it. And Watchmen's amazing.
Watchmen was fucking unbelievable.
And there is no one, I've never talked to anyone more afraid and miserable in my life than Damon Lindelof in the months before it came out. Like, you can never tell if he's joking or not, but he was texting me when I was on location, like, will you hire me because my career's over? Like, he's so successful and he's so thoughtful and careful and good and works harder than anyone else. And he's like, well, I can go back to blogging, you know?
I still feel that way. I think you're in trouble if you don't feel that way.
Yeah.
I really do, because in my opinion, that's when hubris, because that's the best way to describe it, will ruin your career.
So how do you, can I turn it back on you
sure.
for a second? I know we're running out of time, but how do you find, like, because you are in a period of expansion, personally, in a family, and also a lot of restaurants right now, but also media. How do you find presence and equilibrium in the middle of it?
I don't. I mean, you know, Chris Chan, like, if anyone has hung out with me in the past week, they're like, he's out of his fucking mind. Or talk to my wife, because I'm just like, I don't know what the fuck's going on. I don't know how to do restaurants. People are like, how are you doing restaurants and media? I was like, I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
I have no idea. It's freaking me out, because the past week, I'm like, this restaurant shit is going to be the end of me. I have no idea how we're going to do it. It's driving me crazy.
Yeah.
This is going to be the worst restaurant. We're having some problems across the board here. But then I have to think about it. I was like, this has never changed. This has always been the same. And what I've told my shrink is this, is all the problems have changed, but the feeling of dread and existential dread has remained the same.
Yes.
And the way I described this in the book that's coming out is I wanted to learn how to juggle two balls. Now I'm throwing chainsaws and babies.
Yeah.
And I'm still the same amount of scared.
Yeah.
Nothing on that level has changed. Just what I'm throwing in the air is different. But I'm worried now, why do I have to continue to do it? And I mean, you asked the same question about Watchmen creators. Like, how can he feel this bad?
Yeah, there's no, I think we all, and especially people who are on the approaching something big, like that we lie to ourselves that there's the reward of relief. That if you could just do this thing that you've always wanted to do and come out unscathed, then you will be handed a gold watch and a handshake and like you're going to feel better. But you stay the same through all of it. And it's daunting.
I thought he did his own, Lindelof, that's how you pronounce his last name, right? Did his own pre-opening diaries when the last episode came out. Because he did every publication.
Yep.
And did intense interviews about
very frank.
And I thought it was beautiful and brilliant, and there was nothing left to be said about it.
Yeah.
Do you have anything else you want to add? Because, like, that to me was the best thing I'd seen from anyone recently about, like, fuck you guys. This is what it is. Both fuck you to the critics and to, I know, the fan base that are going to be up in arms about how this is going to potentially end.
I mean, I think it's important for me to remember that, like, on the same day that I wake up and I'm getting all these texts from people showing me that they're posters for my show in the subway. There's no greater thing. In the fucking subway. In my subway stop in Brooklyn that I, you know, that I left a few years ago. I'm brushing my teeth being like, am I going to have a panic attack at the dentist today? You know what I mean? Like, it's, you're still just a guy in pajamas living your life. That doesn't change. And it's, you know, people, when they get excited for you and they want you to be lifted up in the excitement that they feel. So I think remembering that is important. But the other thing is, like, this has been a 2 or 3 year journey that has been the most, other than my children, I guess, like the most significant thing of my life. And I really am proud that I have enjoyed it and that I love the people that I worked with and they were healthy relationships, you know? And that's the thing that really matters. I cannot control what people think about the show. I hope that they are entertained by it because I think it's fun. But I also learned that I want to do more.
Yeah, and I think obviously you will, but I think you're wrong. I think that in the sense of if they don't like it, yeah. I'm still stuck on this notion that people may not like something because they're misjudging it still. They're okay. misjudging your intent. It's like some piece of modern art. I may not understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell that they poured their life into this, and I'm going to respect it. I feel that way about restaurants a lot.
Yeah.
Like Vespertine in L.A.
Across the street from where I've been posting.
Have you been there?
No, it's the Dark Tower.
Yeah.
I go to Destroyer, and I get, you know, like
right.
raw egg over potato ash.
We should go there one day because I think what they're doing is so important to
yeah.
food and to the expression of oneself. Do I want to eat there? No, I don't. But
right.
I go there to support it because it has to be supported.
Mm-hmm.
And I may not love it personally, but I love it more than any other restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that's the kind of, when I see critics talking negatively about it, I'm like, you're basically like a MAGA supporter. You know what I mean? It's like you want this reductive world where everything's easy.
Yes.
That's not a real reflection. And I cherish Vespertine because it's so challenging, even though I may not find it always delicious.
We have to have room for all of it. If we're going to say we're a fan of something, if you're a fan of food, or if you're a fan of food culture or of TV, you have to have room in your heart and your mind for all of what that means. And I've been guilty of the opposite early on, and I've told the story on my podcast, but I had this brilliant idea, like some schmuck, like in 1 year into doing this for Grantland, I was going to write a story about why do people even still make multicam sitcoms when The Office and 30 Rock are superior?
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what actually this generation wants. And I talked to Mike Schur, you know, who's a podcaster, creator of The Good Place, Parks and Recreation, wonderful guy. And he was so patient with my snottiness. You know, he's basically like, people use TV in different ways, and that's okay. Because some people turn the TV on after their long day and the rhythms of Two and a Half Men or whatever are the same rhythms that were on TV when you and I came home from school at 5 p.m. and the laughs came when they came. And that's comforting. That's noodles and broth, right? And that's a great thing to enjoy. It's from your childhood. They should also have room in their heart for the young Pope or the new Pope, which, you know, which I love and is a hard watch and is super weird. But you can't have a successful medium or you can't have a successful conversation around it unless you can hold both in your mind, right? At the same time. It's not either or.
People don't like paradox, particularly people consuming TV shows, I don't think.
No, they just like what they like and they get very militant about it.
And I don't know. I haven't watched all the episodes of Briar Patch. Yeah. I'm enjoying it thoroughly.
Thanks.
I was actually at the gym watching it on the link you gave me and someone was like, "Hey, how'd you get that?"
Really?
I was like, "That's Briar Patch."
Hey.
That's nice. That was pretty cool. And I was like, oh.
That's awesome.
I don't know how to explain this.
That makes me happy.
But how do we do this where we have to have some other platform? Because I still believe that whether it's social media that turns into this uni mind or it's food, I mean, and critics, how do we support the people that how do we make sure you have more opportunities?
Well, watch Briar Patch on linear television on February 6th, but I don't know.
I think we can't leave it up to anyone else but the world of creators and people that put stuff out there,
right.
Which is why I want this to be a platform for anyone to be like, this is what I'm doing. This is why it matters to me.
Yeah.
And no bullshit, like, it'll, like, kill me if people don't love it because I've given everything I can to this. And that's the stuff that is moving to me where it's like, wait. Even if it's not perfect, it's perfect like it's your grandma's cooking perfect.
I mean, that's how you're saying something that I feel uncomfortable saying, but it is true. Like, I love these types of stories. I love crime stories. I love stories, and I love things that are funny and weird and moving. But also, I wanted to see if you could use take the armor of a noir, where people dress awesome and look awesome and always know just what to say and what drink to order, and then over 10 episodes, you blow the armor off them and you find out the emotional reasons underneath, and at the start of the show, I would joke that the subtitle for Briar Patch is Rosario Dawson Talks to Weirdos. At the end, I was telling Rosario point blank that the real subtitle is Goes to Therapy Once. and I'm proud of that. It's been more than once. But, you know, some of these ideas about, like, forgiving yourself or acknowledging your own complicity or your are relationships with family that we take for granted, all these things that motivate me to pour them into a fun-shaped box. Like, that was the goal.
And we talk about this 2 months or 3 months after, or let's just say it's like a DVD thing and it's like behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have the same impact, in my opinion, because it's already been out there.
Yeah, and you get desensitized to certain things. Like, yeah. I'm a raw nerve right now.
Right?
Totally.
And no one really gets to see this. This is the craziest, most dangerous point in the process. It's not the actual making of. It's when you've done the fucking work.
It was so much. I spent all last year being like, give me one day off, give me one day off. And then I come blinking into the new year and I'm still busy, but it's like, we're not due on the mix stage until 2 p.m. or actors are coming into ADR at 11. And all of a sudden it's like, holy shit, give me something to do. Because what, you want me to be alone with myself for 4 hours? No, not right now.
Okay, let's, the Briar Patch comes out. What's next? Are you going to go on holiday?
Well,
are you going to read the reviews? Are you going to just
know.
Go to...
I want to take a holiday, but I also want to get going. You know, I want to do more. I have another project that I'm supposed to be writing something for during this supposed lull. I don't know. I just don't know what it's going to feel like, you know? And so maybe it's going to feel great and I'll go on vacation, or maybe it'll feel weird and I'll just sit in my car in a parking lot and look at my phone. I don't know. I'm just trying to be open to it.
We are on the Ringer Network. It's a lot of sports. So I'm going to leave you with this one piece of advice. And it is now like way too much for me to do because people think it's too extreme. Once something is good and something's done, anything good happens, I immediately forget about it.
Yeah.
It's like, I almost internalize it as that is now bad.
Yeah.
And it's a lot like Bill Belichick whenever he wins the Super Bowl. He's like, yeah, who cares?
What have
it's
I done
like,
recently?
Yeah. Next season. We got to get ready.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe like your approach. It's like, okay, because I think it's going to be well received. And hopefully people watch it in droves and you do get season two. But this is your first fucking show. Yeah. I'm excited to see what's coming next.
Who knows? I think the only counter I would say to the Bill Belichick thing is find ways to enjoy it along the way, because there were plateaus. I got to make a pilot. How great. Like the old Jewish song of Dayenu. Like that would be enough. A day on set where Rosario is amazing and we all have a lot of laughs. Be present. Enjoy that, because that is worth enjoying, because you can't control what comes next.
Great advice.
When it's done, don't wait until the end to be like, pat yourself on the back, because you're not going to be able to, because you're going to be losing it. But also, yeah, then it's probably time to take the lessons and move on to the next thing. But
that's good advice for me.
Yeah.
I never enjoy it.
No, me either. I just fake it till you make it. Just keep saying it and sometimes it trickles through. But listening to you talk about it helps me.
Well, there you go.
So
Briar Patch on USA. What days is
Thursdays at 10. The ER slot, baby. Thursdays at 10 on USA.
And if you miss it, it's going to be available on
USA
streaming.
Network. And then eventually it will probably be on a streaming service. But you got to watch it live, man. Come on. It's TV. This isn't streaming, man. This is TV.
All right. Andy, this is pleasure.
Such an honor.
We should
Thank
do a post-opening Diaries.
I'm ready. And you should come on The Watch to talk about TV media when Ugly Delicious comes out, because that's a whole other conversation.
Oh, my God. Now I understand why you don't want to light up all the other critics.
I'm a friend to all.
All right, man.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Can't wait to watch the rest of Briar Patch. USA Network always has some good TV, and Briar Patch, I'm hoping, is a massive hit. This is the first pre-opening Diaries that we've done that wasn't a Momofuku restaurant, so thank you to Andy Greenwald for coming on, being vulnerable, and sharing his worst fears about this process. It is nerve-wracking, and Andy is such a good guy and a brilliant creator, and I wish him nothing but the best. And I think this is a great opportunity for people to come onto this podcast and sort of shoot the shit and enrich the conversation for people that might not understand the actual TV show or anything else. So again, whatever you guys are doing, please come on this show. If you are about to finish a creative project and we can do a pre-opening Diaries, send an email in at askdave@majordomomedia.com or send us a DM on social media at myself or the Dave Chang Show. Anyway, it was a very painful weekend because a lot of people were saddened by the tragic loss of Kobe Bryant and eight others on the plane, including his daughter, Gianna. It's been just sad. It's been a real, real bummer. And it caused me to think about a lot of things. And it's unfortunate and terrible that it's happened. And some tough conversations have been had about Kobe Bryant, his legacy. But I have mostly been moved because of the people that I care about in my life that grew up watching Kobe. They have been, you know, I did not grow up as a Lakers fan, but I've always respected his game. But I was genuinely saddened for the loss, but particularly for the people in my life that love the Lakers and love Kobe Bryant and grew up watching him and his Mamba mentality. And it's never easy. And to watch Keil O'Neal reconcile after he died, and to watch Jerry West talk about how Kobe was incredibly special in his life. I recommend you guys to watch what happened on TNT on NBA or NBA on TNT. I can't remember, but if that wasn't enough with Kobe passing, our friend Jason Polin, a terrific illustrator, cartoonist, artist, was featured in a variety of things. We used to work with him quite a bit on Lucky Peach stuff. He was one of the best people I know, wildly beloved. Chris Ying, who is a producer on this podcast, brought him to Lucky Peach with Walter Green. It's hard talking about this stuff, guys. It causes you to reflect upon a lot of things and what's important in life. And we miss you, Jason. It's incredibly sad that you were taken away from us. You know, he passed away from cancer at the age of 37. Please visit his work. He drew a lot, and he's got some books out there, and he was a prodigious artist. And regardless of his talent as an artist, I think what I will always remember about Jason was just him being one of the sweetest, nicest people in the world. And it's just really sad. And to the people that were much closer to him than myself, I know how devastated they are. And it's been a tough couple years in the food world in general. And my heart goes out to him, his family, and to all his fans that followed his work. And I don't know if New York City will be the same without him writing and drawing all of his thoughts. And every person in New York lost a great artist and a good friend. With that being said, I don't think I'm going to do any questions or emails. I don't think it's appropriate. And I didn't really know if I was going to talk about this stuff today, but tell your friends and family that you love them, and give them a hug. Talk to you guys next week.